Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We have a really interesting stack of sources today, and I have to admit, when I first saw the title of our main paper, The Geometry of Crystals and Polycrystals, I had two immediate thoughts.
Let me guess. One was Superman's Fortress of Solitude.
Yes, just giant glowing spikes everywhere. And the other was that little shop in the mall that sells those amethyst geodes right next to the incense.
Yeah, that is definitely the standard reaction. Crystals kind of occupy this weird space in our culture where they are either magical sci-fi artifacts or just, you know, pretty rocks you put on a shelf.
Right. But we are going to strip all of that away today. Our mission for this deep dive is to look at the hard science. The sources we're unpacking are diving deep into material science and physics. And honestly, the math underneath these things is way more beautiful than the shiny exterior.
It really is.
We're talking about the fundamental rules of how the universe actually organizes itself.
It's all about organization. And the deeper you look into this research, mm-hmm. the more you realize that the word crystal isn't a description of appearance at all. It's a rigorous mathematical definition. It has nothing to do with being clear or shiny.
No.
No, it is entirely about one core concept, order.
Order. Okay, so let's start right there. The definition of a crystal. Because when you look at nature, I mean, you look at forests, clouds, ocean waves, you generally see chaos, randomness. But you're saying a crystal is the exact opposite of that.
Precisely.
Yeah.
The sources define a crystal by its periodicity. Basically, a crystal is a solid where the atoms are arranged in a regular repeating pattern that extends over large distances.
A repeating pattern?
Yeah, it is nature's copy-paste function, just running on an infinite loop.
Okay, so to really get why that matters for you listening at home, we need to contrast it with something. What is the alternative to a crystal?
The alternative is what we call an amorphous material. Right, think of glass or a plastic polymer or even just a liquid. In those materials, the atoms are just a jumbled mess. They are close together, but there is no long-range plan.
So it's like a crowd of people at a concert versus a marching band.
That is a perfect analogy. Mm. The source material uses a really helpful data comparison here, actually.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to describe the structure of a piece of glass to me perfectly.
An amorphous material.
Exactly. You would literally have to send me the unique XYZ coordinates for every single atom in that piece of glass.
Because there's no pattern at all. I'd have to map, what, a trillion random points?
Trillions. It would be a massive, completely uncompressible data file. But for a crystal, you don't need the coordinates of a trillion atoms. You just need to describe the repeat unit.
Which is what?
It's usually just a tiny box containing a handful of atoms.
Yeah.
You describe that box and then tell me the mathematical rule for how to stack it.
Oh, wow. So I just give you one brick in the instructions to repeat forever.
And with just that tiny bit of information, you can mentally construct a crystal the size of a planet. That is the power of long-range order.
That distinction order versus chaos seems to be the root of everything else in this research. And the first big concept that jumped out at me from the reading, which sounds like a very expensive vocabulary word, is anisotropy.
Yes, anisotropy. This is really the so what of crystallography.
Yeah.
If order is the definition, anisotropy is the consequence.
Let's break that down.
It's simple if you look at the roots. Iso means same.
Yeah.
Tropic refers to direction. So amorphous materials, that messy glass we talked about, are isotropic.
Because they're a random jumble.
Right.
Yeah.
The properties average out. If you push on a block of glass or try to conduct electricity through it or heat it up, it behaves the exact same way no matter which direction you test it.
Because it's equally average in every direction. The chaos just cancels itself out.
Exactly. But a crystal has a grain. It has an internal bias. Because the atoms are lined up in specific rows and columns, the microscopic environment changes depending on which angle you look at it.
I was trying to visualize this while reading. Is it like standing in a cornfield?
That works perfectly. Imagine you are standing in a planted cornfield. If you look straight down the rows, you see clear open paths stretching all the way to the horizon.
Right.
But if you just turn 45 degrees and look diagonally across the rows, the plants suddenly look much closer together. They create a visual wall.
So the density looks totally different depending on where I'm standing.
That is exactly what happens inside a crystal. In one direction, the atoms might be packed super tight. In another direction, they are spaced out. So if you try to shine light through it, or squash it, or run a current through it, the crystal resists differently depending on the angle.
It has a directional personality.
Yes. That is anisotropy. The properties depend on the direction.
And the source mentions this isn't just some scientific quirk we have to deal with. It's actually something we use.
Oh, it's incredibly useful. Think about electronics. If you're building a high-speed computer chip, you need to know exactly how electrons will travel through the silicon. You can't afford for the material to be average. You need it to be predictable in a highly specific direction to optimize speed and efficiency.
So we are leveraging that internal geometry to make our tech work.
Absolutely.
Now, we usually think of these rows and columns in 3D, like a cube of salt or a diamond, but the reading took a detour into dimensions that I found really surprising. It started exploring 2D, 1D, and even 4D crystals.
Yeah, the dimensional breakdown is fascinating because it tests the very limits of physics. Let's start with 2D, because that is the one that has revolutionized material science in the last 20 years. Graphene is the poster child here.
Graphene is the buzzword of the century. I feel like you see headlines about it every single week.
For good reason. The text describes graphene as a single layer of carbon atoms arranged in a honeycomb lattice. It is essentially a 2D crystal, just one atom thick.
And you get it by essentially peeling layers off graphite, right? Like pencil lead.
Correct. Graphite is just thick stacks of these 2D graphene sheets loosely bonded together. When you isolate just one single sheet, it behaves mathematically as a two-dimensional object.
And that changes its properties.
Drastically. Because of that unique 2D lattice structure, it has wild properties. It's stronger than steel and conducts electricity better than almost anything else we know of.
Okay, so 2D is very real. But then the source asks an interesting question. Can you have a 1D crystal? Can you have just a single string of atoms floating in space?
And the answer is theoretically yes, but practically, nature says no.
Why not? We make nanowires. I've seen pictures of them.
We do. But the physicist cited in the text, Zeeman, points out a major catch. To keep a line of atoms straight, you have to put them inside something, like a carbon nanotube or a tiny groove on a substrate.
Okay, so you just put in a container.
But the moment you do that, the atoms in your 1D line start interacting with the atoms in the 3D container. They bond, they push, they pull. So it's not an isolated 1D system anymore. It instantly becomes part of a complex 3D system.
So a truly isolated 1D crystal is basically impossible.
Zeeman literally calls it physically unrealizable. It's too unstable. The thermal energy, just the atoms vibrating from having any temperature above absolute zero, would eventually snap the line if it wasn't physically supported. It's a unicorn.
Okay, so 1D is a bust. But then we go to the other extreme, 4D crystals, time crystals. When I read that, I honestly assumed the source had switched to science fiction.
It sounds totally made up, doesn't it? But this is a real concept that Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek proposed. We know a normal crystal repeats in space. Step to the left, step to the right, the pattern repeats. A time crystal is a structure that repeats in time.
My brain struggles with that. What does that physically look like?
Imagine a cylindrical collection of atoms. In a normal crystal, they settle into a stable, stationary pattern. In a time crystal, the atomic structure flips between states in a regular repeating rhythm as time moves forward.
Like a ticking clock.
Yes, but here is the kicker. It does this even when it is in its absolute lowest energy state, its ground state.
Wait, if it's moving or flipping, isn't that using energy?
That is the big controversy. The source highlights this tension beautifully. If something is constantly changing state, it feels like a perpetual motion machine, which physics strictly forbids. You can't get energy for free.
Physics hates a free lunch.
It really does. The source notes that the big debate is whether these things can be everlasting without eventually radiating their energy away. We've actually created these in labs using quantum computers, but they are incredibly fragile. It's a weird frontier where quantum mechanics kind of breaks our intuition about thermodynamics.
I love that we went from shiny rocks to perpetual motion machines in about 10 minutes. But let's bring it back to Earth for a second. I want to talk about shapes. Because if you go to a museum and look at a chunk of pyrite fool's gold, it's a perfect cube. Sharp corners, completely flat sides. It looks like it was machined in a factory.
It's stunning to look at, and people often assume the atoms must be tiny cubes themselves to make a big cube.
Right. But we know atoms are essentially spheres, so why does nature build sharp corners out of spheres?
It comes back to laziness. Or, more accurately, energy conservation. Nature always wants to reach the lowest possible energy state.
Okay, I can relate to being lazy.
Well, for an isotropic liquid, like a water droplet floating in zero gravity, the lowest energy shape is a perfect sphere. It has the smallest surface area for a given volume. But remember, crystals are anisotropic.
Right, the properties change with direction.
Exactly. That implies that creating a surface on one side of the crystal costs more energy than creating a surface on another side. It depends entirely on how the chemical bonds are cut. Some atomic planes are cheap to expose, and some are very expensive.
So the crystal grows in a way that maximizes those cheap surfaces.
Spot on. It sacrifices the spherical shape to save energy on the surface types. It builds itself into a cube or an octagon because those flat faces correspond to the atomic planes that are the most energetically favorable. The shape you see in the museum is essentially an energy budget calculation made visible.
That is a fascinating way to look at it. But humans aren't always satisfied with squares and cubes. The source had this incredible image of a turbine blade, a high-tech, twisted metal blade for a jet engine. And the captain said it was a single crystal.
This is truly one of the greatest achievements in modern engineering. It completely flips the natural order on its head.
Explain that to me, because that blade is big. It's the size of my forearm. How can that entire functional shape be one single crystal?
Well, first we have to understand why we need it to be one crystal. Most metals, the stuff we interact with every day, are polycrystalline. They're aggregates made of millions of tiny microscopic crystals glued together.
Like a mosaic or a puzzle.
Yes. And the boundaries where those little crystals meet are weak points. Now, inside a jet engine, you have temperatures hitting 1,000 degrees Celsius and massive centrifugal forces trying to rip the blade apart.
It's basically a torture chamber for metal.
Under those conditions, if you use a normal piece of metal, something terrifying happens. The atoms start to slide along those grain boundaries. The blade literally lengthens. It stretches out over time. It's called creep.
And if the blade stretches inside an engine casing that is built to millimeter tolerances,
it hits the wall and explodes, which is a very bad day for the plane. So engineers figured out a way to cast a metal so that it solidifies as one continuous lattice. No grain boundaries whatsoever. No weak points. The atoms are locked in lockstep from the base of the blade all the way to the tip.
So we forced the crystal to take a shape that isn't natural, an aerodynamic fan blade, but we kept that internal mathematical order to get the strength.
Exactly. We hijacked the geometry to survive the harsh environment. We eliminated the sliding mechanism by eliminating the boundaries altogether.
That is such an aha moment. Now let's get into the nuts and bolts of this geometry. We've been using the word lattice a lot. The source material gets pretty technical here with terms like unit cells and Miller indices. I want to parse this so we can really understand the language scientists use to talk about this order.
Think of the lattice as the imaginary grid. It's an infinite array of points in space where every point has an identical view. If you were an ant standing on one lattice point, the universe would look exactly the same as if you stood on any other point.
Okay, so the lattice is the map.
And the unit cell is the tile. It's a parallel pipette, basically the 3D box. And it's the smallest building block you can draw that connects those points. If you take that box and stack it, you fill all the space.
And the text lists all these alphabet soup types. Primitive, face-centered, body-centered. This is just describing where the atoms sit inside that box.
Right. It's all about packing efficiency. Mm-hmm. Primitive, denoted by a P, is the simplest. You just have lattice points at the eight corners of the cell. That's one total lattice point per cell if you do the math.
What about the others?
Body-centered means you have the corners plus one atom floating smack in the center of the box. That's actually denoted by an I, which comes from the German word for inner-centered. And face-centered, or F, has points at the corners plus atoms sitting right on the faces of the box. 4 points total.
Why does a listener care if there is an atom in the center of the box or not?
It determines density and behavior. How tightly can you cram stuff in? A primitive box is mostly empty space. A face-centered box is packed very tight. This dictates how heavy the material is, how easily atoms can slide past each other, and even things like how brittle the material is. Gold, for example, is face-centered cubic, which is a big part of why it's so dense but also so malleable.
And then we have the Miller indices. The source shows these numbers in square brackets like 100 or 111. I assume this is the address system.
Think of it exactly like a GPS. Since the crystal is anisotropic, since it has those different properties in different directions we talked about, scientists need a standardized way to navigate. They need to be able to say, look down this specific diagonal.
So one isn't just a random number, it's a vector.
It acts as an address system for directions within the crystal. If I tell a colleague to check the stress on the 111 plane, they know exactly which avenue of atoms we are discussing.
Now here's the part of the text that felt almost philosophical to me. You'd think that with infinite space, there would be infinite ways to arrange points, just endless architectural combinations. But the source says no. There are strict limits.
This is a famous discovery by Auguste Bravais in 1848. He proved mathematically that there are only 14 possible distinct ways to arrange points in 3D space so that they repeat perfectly.
Only 14? In the entire universe?
For a periodic lattice, yes. These 14 patterns are the Bravais lattices, and we can group them into just 7 crystal systems.
So everything from table salt to diamonds to the silicon in my phone fits into one of these 7 buckets.
Correct. They range on a spectrum from the least symmetric, which is the triclinic system, sort of like a shoebox that's been kicked so it's slanted in every possible direction, to the most symmetric, the cubic system.
And the source makes a really important distinction here that I think trips people up. We can't just look at a shape and say, oh, it's a cube because it has square sides.
Right. In crystallography, symmetry isn't defined by shape. It's defined by rotation.
Give me an example of that. How do I mathematically prove something is a cube?
Take a literal cube. If you hold it by opposite corners, the body diagonal, and spin it, there are positions where it looks identical to how it started. For a system to be officially cubic, it must have 4 specific axes where you can rotate it 120 degrees and it looks exactly the same. These are called triads.
So if I have a box that looks totally square, but it doesn't have those 4 axes of rotation,
then it is not cubic. It might be trigonal, which only has 1 triad. It creates a very rigorous mathematical definition. Symmetry is the law. Shape is just a byproduct. You can't cheat the rotation test.
That's wild. A crystal is defined by how it behaves when you manipulate it, not just how it measures with a ruler. We need to zoom back out to the real world before we finish up here. We talked about the single crystal turbine blade earlier, but you mentioned that most stuff, my desk, my car, the frame of this building, is polycrystalline.
Yes. Almost all engineering materials are aggregates. They are billions of tiny crystals squished together.
And the source brings up a term here that I usually associate with fabric or painting, texture.
In material science, texture doesn't mean how it feels to the touch. It means the degree of randomness in how those little crystals are oriented. Imagine a school of fish.
Okay, a school of fish.
If the fish are all swimming in random directions, darting everywhere, that is what we call random texture. But if they all turn and swim north together, that is strong texture.
And since we know crystals have directional properties, anisotropy, getting them to swim the same way must be important.
It's critical. Take the aluminum in an ordinary beverage can. You manufacture that can by punching a flat sheet of metal into a cup shape. You are stretching the metal intensely. It's a process called deep drawing.
Right. It has to stretch into a cylinder without ripping.
If the microscopic crystals in that aluminum sheet are randomly oriented, or oriented the wrong way, the metal will tear. The can will fail. You have to carefully engineer the processing, the rolling, and the heating so that the crystals all align in a specific texture that allows them to stretch together smoothly.
So a basic soda can is actually a feat of crystallographic engineering.
A massive one. Same with the steel cores and electrical transformers. If you don't align the crystals, if you don't control that texture, the transformer hums, gets hot, and wastes a ton of energy. The magnetic fields need an easy path to flow through, and texture provides that path.
And the weak link in all this polycrystalline stuff is the boundary, right? The space between the fish.
The grain boundary.
Yeah.
Connecting 2 different crystals is geometrically very complicated. The source notes it takes 5 degrees of freedom just to describe the interface where 2 crystals meet.
Why 5? That seems excessive for just 2 blocks touching.
It's surprisingly complex. You need 2 numbers just to define the plane they touch on, the angle of the interface itself. And then you need 3 more numbers to define how the second crystal is twisted or rotated relative to the first one.
So it's a total mesh at that boundary.
It is. The atoms don't fit perfectly. There are gaps and stresses. This is where impurities gather, a process called segregation. This is where corrosion starts. This is where cracks nucleate.
It seems like the boundary is just as important as the crystal itself for engineers.
In many ways, yes. The boundary influences the toughness of the material. If you have no boundaries, like the turbine blade, you get extreme high temperature strength, but maybe less toughness. If you have many boundaries, you can actually stop cracks from spreading easily. It's a constant trade-off.
We've covered a huge amount of ground today, from the basic definition of order and the reality of anisotropy, all the way to the 14 Bravais lattices and the texture of a soda can.
It really connects the abstract math to the things you touch every single day.
What's the one thing you want everyone to take away from this? If someone listening forgets the Miller indices and the rotation axes, what should stick with them?
For me, it's that geometry determines destiny. We tend to think of materials based solely on their ingredients. You know, this is iron, this is carbon, this is silicon. But this deep dive really highlights that how the atoms are arranged is just as critical as what they actually are.
Can you give us one final example of that?
Carbon is the perfect example. A diamond and a pencil lead are both made of 100% carbon. Identical ingredients. The only difference is the geometry. One is the hardest substance in nature. The other is soft enough to smear on paper. That extreme difference is entirely due to the lattice structure we discussed today.
That's a powerful thought. It's not just the ingredients, it's the recipe. I want to leave everyone with one final thought from the source that I found really provocative. We've spent this entire time talking about the perfect internal order of crystals, how the pattern repeats forever. But the source mentions that when you get to the surface, the very outer skin of the crystal, all those rules just break.
Ah, yes. Surface reconstruction. This is a brilliant area of study.
Because the atoms at the surface don't have neighbors above them. They are exposed to the void, so they're completely unstable.
Right. They have what we call dangling bonds. They're desperately looking for something to hold on to, and there's nothing there.
So they literally rearrange themselves. They form a totally different pattern than the interior just to survive the exposure.
That's right. The surface forces create a skin that is structurally different from the bulk material inside. The atoms might buckle or pair up or completely change their spacing.
Which means, technically, we never actually touch a crystal. We only ever touch this reconstructed, modified skin. The true, perfect order is always locked away inside, protected by this chaotic layer.
And yet that messy, reconstructed surface is where all the interesting chemistry happens. It's where catalysts work to clean our exhaust or refine our fuel. The imperfection of the surface is exactly what makes it reactive and useful to us.
A hidden order protected by a chaotic skin. What a concept! Thank you for walking us through the geometry of the universe today.
It was my pleasure.
And to you listening, the next time you pick up a soda can or look at a gemstone, just remember the billions of atoms lined up inside holding it all together. See you on the next deep dive.